In the phrase of William James, the attainment of any good comes by butchering some other part of reality.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Erraticus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 20 of Damn the Absolute. This will be the final episode of the season before we take a summer break. I want to take a moment to express my sincere appreciation to each of the guests and to you, the community of listeners around the show. We plan to return in the fall, but in the meantime, please let us know who you'd like us to have on the show or which topics you'd like us to explore next season. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Damn the Absolute is now on YouTube as well. You can also reach us by email at damntheabsolute@erraticus.co. That is Damn the Absolute without the exclamation mark. Enjoy the episode. Pragmatists do not hold absolute faith in any particular value, principle, or belief. This applies even to the many concepts affiliated with pragmatists, such as pluralism, fallibilism, democracy, and naturalism. They focus on experience as the field in which we continually test out and reconstruct our views of the world and determine what works in our particular place and time. Pragmatism is focused on concrete results in experience, judging ideas and beliefs according to their fruits and not their roots. For a pragmatist, the world is constantly changing, not just our views or understanding of it. The questions that were relevant 2 millennia ago may no longer be relevant today. This requires new solutions and novel practices. Pragmatism offers an approach to the human experience that will resonate with some and not with others. If so, is pragmatism best understood as a temperament, a method? Is it a theory of truth, or is it primarily a way of viewing the world? John Stuart is Arts and Sciences Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and American Studies at Emory University, where he chaired the Department of Philosophy from 2008 to 2016. He is the author or editor of over a dozen books, including Pragmatism, Postmodernism, and the Future of Philosophy, Pragmatic Fashions, Pluralism, Democracy, Relativism, and the Absurd, and 100 Years of Pragmatism, the Revolutionary Philosophy of William James. Stuart thinks of pragmatism more as a fashion or season of belief. It's a temporal philosophy. If reality weren't constantly changing, then we could assert a truth and hold onto it for eternity. Instead, by leaning into experience and viewing truth as provisional, we can continue to adapt to changing circumstances. This provides us with a dynamic means through which we can improve our communities and our personal lives just a little more each day. That is, if we are willing to do the work. Because for a pragmatist, the future is never guaranteed. A few questions to consider. How does pragmatism avoid devolving into reckless relativism? How might a pragmatist approach questions of what it means to live well? What is the future of philosophy, and what role can pragmatism play in our pursuit of truth? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We have a ritual of sorts at Damn the Absolute. We'd like to start off with this question. What is a viewpoint you've held in adulthood you were confident wouldn't change that's actually shifted dramatically for you?
Well, first, let me say that I'm not sure that I have that many views that I was confident would not change dramatically. In the future, the world changes, life changes, so I kind of expect my views will change going forward. So I think of my views as, for the most part, pretty open to revision and as life forcing revision on them with some frequency. But that point noted, let me mention two viewpoints. Let me respond with two examples of what you're talking about. And let me now focus on particulars. So I don't mean like I didn't predict that Trump would win the presidency, or I never expected the Chicago Cubs to win the World Series in my lifetime, right? But so sort of more generally, first, as a kind of confident, can-do, roll-up-the-sleeve 20- and 30-year-old, I thought that it would be possible to make progress on major social problems in a much faster and more concerted and more effective way. If someone had told me on the first Earth Day that world environmental and climate problems would be much worse, much more dire today, I would have found that nearly impossible and did not believe that at the time. You know, if someone had told me that racial divisions and injustices and inequality and violence would be so omnipresent and deeply embedded today, decades after the 1960s civil rights movement, including the Voting Act, I would have found that to be unwarranted and certainly wouldn't have held that view, right? And would have thought that that was overly pessimistic. If somebody had told me to prepare for massive, unprecedented economic inequality, I would have thought, no, things will be better, right? And I can go on with those examples. If someone had told me that there would be continuing strong opposition to gender equality and ongoing sex-based discrimination and bias and violence, I would have thought that American society some 50 years later would have been in a better position, and mass gun violence and so on and so forth. So I could continue with these examples, but the point is I used to significantly underestimate the extent and power of resistance to progressive democratic social change and the clear need to more fully practice the core values that this country preaches. My commitment to this change hasn't lessened, so that's not what has changed. It's just that my appreciation of the strengths and complexity of opposition to the change has really increased. So that's been a big change of view for me. And then the last thing, and this will be my sort of most long-winded response, I promise, is that perhaps more personally, while I was aware of the dangers, the obvious dangers of failure, I think we're all aware of that growing up through school, right? I failed for some long time to take sufficient note of the dangers of success. And I know that sounds strange. And what do I mean by that? And so it's so easy in striving for success, in actually obtaining success. For professors, that's the stuff of getting tenure and promotions and winning grants and having books published. It's so easy in striving for success not to notice the ways in which the success forges an image of oneself, an image that other people then hold and that you hold yourself, and it becomes repeated and frozen in time. And so the danger of success is, I think, the danger of fixed habits in a changing world. The danger that being rewarded for thinking in one way or performing in a particular manner leads one to stop growing, to stop learning, to stay in place, right? And so I think the danger is that you can become your own oldies band. You can become your own reunion tour, you know? And so people want you to repeat what they've said before. They like that. And so I think that when this happens, it's just so easy to stop being creative. And I did not used to be sufficiently aware of the need that I think we all have to protect ourselves against becoming the band that just plays our own greatest hits over and over again. And that's definitely something that I've paid more attention to in, say, the last decade. It's not something that I thought was an issue in the past, and it's certainly a change for me.
Well, hopefully this discussion doesn't feel like a Van Halen reunion tour for you.
I promise not to make it that.
You've spent a lot of time in the philosophical tradition of American pragmatism. Your views have changed a lot through the few decades you spent engaging with that tradition. What does pragmatism mean to you?
Well, that's a big question, right? And so like any ism, pragmatism means multiple things, and in different contexts, it means different things. It's one of the few philosophy words that is used in a different way in the public today. So when people talk about somebody being a pragmatist, a politician being a pragmatist, what they mean kind of is the person has no commitments to principles at all and just sort of does whatever works. And that captures something about pragmatism, the sort of focus on things working, but that itself is a theory. And so the idea that you can be without a theory is definitely not what pragmatism means. I think of pragmatism in terms of other isms like experimentalism, fallibilism, radical empiricism, a kind of commitment to community. But pragmatism to me more than sort of, if somebody sort of said like, so what kind of thing is pragmatism? What I would say is I think of pragmatism primarily as a temperament. William James called it a temperament or a worldview. I view it as a working attitude, an attitude that is focused on consequences that lets practice drive theory. And I view it as committed to experimental inquiry, by which I don't mean anything particular to lab sciences. I just mean whatever experience shows us to be the case, to be effective, pragmatism is committed to that. So I take it, I know that philosophers like to think of schools of thought in terms of these are the necessary and sufficient conditions you have to believe to be an X, I don't think that's actually very helpful. I think of pragmatism more as a kind of view of the world. This is the way in which one encounters the world. Pragmatism is a kind of focus on last things and on consequences.
Yeah, I think from my own experience, when I'm talking with other philosophically minded people, there aren't many people who will identify so much as a pragmatist as much as they will approach things in a pragmatic way. As you talked about, there's a certain attitude and an intellectual humility or curiosity that's focused on how does this work in the end, rather than a, as you said, a list of secure values that a pragmatist checks the box.
Yeah, I think so. And in addition to that, there are certain other themes that are central, or at least have been central, to what pragmatism amounts to. So there is a kind of fallibilistic attitude as opposed to holding absolute truth. So there's a kind of damn the absolute attitude in pragmatism from the beginning. That's a kind of epistemic humility. It's that any view that we have is not immune from future revision. There's a kind of commitment to experimentalism, to inquiry, as opposed to holding on to custom or authority. Right? Let's see what experience shows to be the case. And I think there's a commitment to the notion that the individual is a social being, is a social product. And so there's a focus on community and the individual as a member of a community rather than an isolated individual. The inquiry itself is communal rather than individual. Right. So I think, and pragmatism is certainly also committed to a kind of pluralism, to the recognition that different people may actually have different kinds of experiences. But I agree with you. I mean, I think also that lots of philosophers, they don't want to be pigeonholed or labeled to, like, don't call me a this, you know, I'm my own unique self. But I think that pragmatism in this kind of broad sense as a kind of working worldview is actually a very broad, is really a very broad-based philosophy. I think that sort of all people who engage in the practice of science, for example, not necessarily the theory, but the practice, I think those people are pragmatists. They are acting in a pragmatic way. And another point that I think is really crucial to understanding pragmatism is one that flies in the face of the way in which pragmatism is sometimes thought. I think that sometimes people think pragmatism is a kind of happy, optimistic, peculiarly American philosophy. And I think that nothing could be farther from the truth about pragmatism. It's actually, in my view, the philosophy that is most attuned to human tragedy. It has the most tragic view of human life, I think, by which I mean three things. Pragmatists recognize in the first place that sometimes you strive for an end and you fail to obtain it. That's tragic. I tried to save my mother and she died. I didn't get what I wanted. So there's that obvious sense of tragedy. There's a second sense that I think is deeper, in that pragmatists recognize that even when you do achieve the end that you're striving for, that comes at the loss of, the permanent forever loss of, all kinds of other opportunities, of all kinds of other goods. So all of those hours that you spent practicing piano inside to become this great musician now, those were hours you didn't play soccer with your friends, and those were hours you didn't talk with your parents. And so, in the phrase of William James, the attainment of any good comes by butchering some other part of reality. And so you lose when you lose, and you also lose when you win. And then third, for pragmatists, of course, human beings lead finite lives, and so we die. And so pragmatism is a this-worldly, temporal, finite philosophy, and it tells you your life is going to be marked sometimes by not achieving what you strive for, sometimes by achieving what you strive for, but by giving up all kinds of other goods along the way. And at the end of the day, you die. And I think that a lot of folks who object to pragmatism are looking for a less strenuous message. Some happier note. So I actually view pragmatism as the more tragic, the more clear-eyed, tough view here. I think that a lot of times folks who seek the absolute are seeking some way around the fact of their own finitude. And pragmatism tells you, no, your life is finite and it will be marked over and over again by tragedies small and large.
With pragmatism, as you're presenting it, being so focused on change and not being a set of checklists of what a pragmatist believes in, what might a pragmatist put their faith in? The most solid, I don't want to say foundation, but the most assured place that a pragmatist is going to say, I can put some reliance on this.
Yeah, not saying foundation is good. What can a pragmatist put faith in? I think that what a pragmatist has greatest faith in is the capacity of experience to intelligently reconstruct itself. the capacity of experience itself, no need for some sort of supernatural otherworldly invention, the capacity of human experience itself to find what works and what doesn't work, and to bit by bit adapt and reconstruct itself to move forward. I view it as having faith in human experience. It's a this worldly focused philosophy, and it's one that thinks of intelligence as a possibility for experience, that we can perhaps maddeningly slowly and with lots of failures along the way, we can become more intelligent in the way that we approach problems. We can lead more meaningful and more fulfilling lives. So I think it's not a it's not faith in a particular doctrine. It's not faith in some particular absolute or foundational or fundamentalist principle. It's faith in a process of intelligence over time to correct itself, to reconstruct itself.
I wonder if framing might be the difference between orthodoxy versus orthopraxy, where pragmatism doesn't have a set of beliefs that a pragmatist has to abide by. It's the focus on the proper practice. And the practice of a pragmatist is, as you explained, of focusing on continually reconstructing what is considered a useful view or idea to hold.
Yeah, and what is considered and what is found in experience to be useful. I think the parallel here that at least some folks would be familiar with is science can be understood as a method rather than as faith in a particular result. And so the scientist recognizes that some later experiment may call into question, may undo, may force revision of prior views. But what the scientist, the working scientist, has faith in is the capacity of the method to do that. And so I think that when philosophers like Peirce, James, and Dewey define pragmatism as a method, that signals some similarities with the way in which science is understood as a method. It's a commitment to a process of investigation rather than to any particular findings, right? And the last thing I would say is, it's like, why is that important, right? Because pragmatism is committed to the view that reality actually changes. It's a temporal philosophy. It's not a philosophy of the infinite, absolute, unchanging world. It's not a commitment to Platonic forms. It's a view to the fact that reality changes. If reality didn't change, we could perhaps get views and then we would have them correct and they would be right for all time. But it's precisely because reality actually changes. Reality is a process. It's in change. It's in flux, that the beliefs of an earlier time may not be well suited. They may not be borne out in a later time.
I'll try and avoid this turning into a reunion tour for you, but I want to look a little bit backward at some of the classical pragmatists. William James, John Dewey, when they were ushering in pragmatism, they viewed it as the maybe a philosophical equivalent of the Protestant Reformation or the Copernican Revolution. They saw it as the future of philosophy. Why were they wrong? Or why is pragmatism not the future of philosophy?
You're right. They did talk that way, right? And as you know, and kind of the way you framed that refers to James's message to his brother, Henry James, the less good writer of the James brothers, that his pragmatism would be greater than the Protestant Reformation. So I'm not sure, actually. I would make the case that I think that he is largely correct, actually. So there's the Protestant Reformation, but that doesn't mean that everybody today is a Protestant. They're not, right? So did the Protestant Reformation fail? Well, right, we'd have to talk about what that means. So I think that pragmatism, I would draw a distinction between two things. One is the kind of technical academic sense of what it is to be a pragmatist, the kind of thing that shows up in university catalogs and the philosophers go to subspecialty conferences about and so on. And clearly, most people are not pragmatists in the philosophy world in that sense, right, in that sort of narrow academic sense. But I think in a broader sense of kind of the worldview that people have, the world view is increasingly experimental and is increasingly focused on concrete results in experience and is increasingly putting its faith in the method of experience to reveal nature and for us to do better. So I think that I think that pragmatism has been widely successful and influential across a lot of disciplines and across a lot of aspects of lives. That said, pragmatists are pluralistic, and so they recognize not everyone may see the world this way. So is that a failure, right? Is it a failure of impressionism if that's not everybody's favorite painting? I don't know that that's a failure of impressionism. It just means it doesn't resonate with certain folks. It doesn't move them. You know, my dad used to take me to the opera in Chicago. It just never took. It just doesn't work for me. Is that a failure of opera? I don't think so, right? And so the idea that the success of a philosophy would be measured by the fact that everyone in the world subscribes to it, I don't think that's right. Right? I think that there will always be diversity among people, and certain worldviews are going to be appealing and resonate with other folks. But I would say, I think that since the time of people like James and Dewey, I think that we are at least as much, if not all the way, toward a kind of commitment to a lot of pragmatic themes, to pluralism, to fallibilism, to experimentalism, to concern with community. So I think that it's both a view that has been largely successful, right? And the last thing to say is that James said, he didn't claim that he invented this, right? He said people like Aristotle and Hume and Mill were pragmatists. And so he thinks what he's doing is sort of formalizing a view that's been around for a long time. And I think that that view still is around. And I think that large numbers of people hold that view in some aspects of their lives. And then there are other folks for whom, for a variety of reasons, that just doesn't seem to resonate. It doesn't seem to reflect their experience for them. And again, I don't think it's the task of any particular philosopher to try to beat, you know, submission out of every last living human being in order to be successful. That's not, I think that would be a strange thing, especially for pragmatism. It would be at odds with its very pluralism. And so I think that this has been a strong theme in people's thinking, not just among weird philosophy professors, but among people generally, you know, for a long time. And so in that sense, I think it's successful.
You're already alluding to this a little bit, but I want to give you a chance to really a little bit more clearly articulate it. You've expressed philosophy as something expressivistic, like an art form akin to painting or poetry. You've written about it as a fashion. What exactly does it mean for philosophy or a philosophy to be a fashion?
Yeah. So let me say just a couple quick things about that, right? So we think that the clothes that we wear are matters of fashion, right? We don't wonder why didn't 14th century Aborigines in Australia wear what we wear in downtown Seattle today. We think of these as culturally relative, as fashions, that they are cultural products and they're tied to the particular lives and conditions of certain people. So I think of philosophy the same way. What we eat, what we wear, what we think is tied to particular cultures. And in that sense, as those cultures change and come and go, philosophies are themselves seasons of belief, playing off of a line from a Wallace Stevens poem. Those are seasons of belief. Would we really expect that a view that was forged in ancient Athens would still be held by folks after Newton, after Einstein, after Darwin? That seems kind of implausible. It's that a Platonic view now seems in some ways to have passed because the conditions of our life are different, in the same way that we don't wear togas, we don't dress the same, we don't think the same. When we use the word philosophy, I want to be really clear that for me, that's a word that has two distinct meanings. One is a kind of technical academic sense in which philosophy is a discipline and it's separate from English and it's separate from religion and so on. Even though I'm in the academy, I find that to be a tremendously uninteresting notion of philosophy, right? Another sense of philosophy is one's working attitude toward the world, the sense in which everyone has a philosophy, even if they don't ever take a philosophy class, even if they don't reflect on it. There is a philosophy that's expressed in the way that they live. There is a worldview that is evident in the choices that they make. And that's the sense in which I think of philosophy, not so much as a discipline of knowledge, but as an art, as a performance. I think of philosophy as essentially the generation of creative ideas. Philosophies, I think, say to you, what if you see the world this way? Right? And you may think, no, I can't see the world this way. Right. So I think of philosophy, and I have said before, I think of philosophy in a way as a kind of extended junior year abroad. Right. I view it as like, let me take a trip to Hegelland. I may not want to live there, but let's see how things look from that standpoint. And so I think of the greatest philosophies as inventive, imaginative, creative, saying to you, what if you see the world like this? And it's always open for you to come back and say, can't do it. Doesn't resonate. Doesn't work. Right? but it may be that you think, oh, there's something there. That's very illuminating. That's helpful. So that's the sense in which I think of philosophy as an art. I don't think of philosophy as a discipline because I don't think that there's an agreed upon method in philosophy. And I don't think that there's any body of knowledge that's only philosophies and not something else.
There's a certain relativism that comes into play here. And I know someone listening might wonder, well, how do I take certain communities in Africa embrace genital mutilation, often involuntarily, whereas my community here in Seattle is appalled. Many are appalled by that notion. How might I hold these two in my hand and make a judgment? Or do I just say, oh, that's a way in which people in that community fashion their lifestyles, and this is a way in which we in Seattle fashion our lifestyles? How do we resolve this or evaluate those differences?
First, I think we begin by recognizing that there are those differences. Right. And so from a, not speaking from a philosophical standpoint, but from an anthropological standpoint, it's clear that there are different cultures that have different practices and that some of the values of some stand in stark opposition to some of the values of others. Right. So that there are those differences both in the world today and over time is without question. Right. And so then the question is kind of a moral one, what to think about it. There's, I think, kind of a reflex action on the part of a lot of folks to think like, well, I want to show that my values are correct. We're different. X and Y are different, but I want to show that X is correct. And so in order to do that, I have to appeal to something, so the thinking goes, outside of our cultures. Otherwise, it becomes circular. I can't appeal to my own cultural norms to defend them. That's logically begging the question. So that's what can motivate people to search for some sort of either cultural constants or cultural absolutes, right? And to worry about relativism as where you're left if you can't answer that question. So I think that's the, I think that the sort of fear of relativism is the fear that it becomes impossible to justify commitment to any one set of values as opposed to some other set of values. And so we're left with, well, you chose to storm the Capitol on this day in January and I didn't, and we're just different, right? And so that seems unsatisfactory. And so the push is then to some sort of more absolute view. So I want to just sort of begin by acknowledging, I think that's kind of where we are. And that kind of view, I think, is actually not relativism at all, but it's a view that I would call subjectivism, by which I mean the view that whatever one thinks is therefore right or correct for me. And so I don't know anybody who has ever held a kind of relativism position who thinks that's correct. It would be nice in the way if it were correct. It would be nice if all I had to do was think of something and then it would be right. But the world's not that way. Right. And it just simple examples show that that's not the case. If I think that drinking Clorox bleach after a hard basketball game is going to satisfy my thirst, it just turns out, even if I thought that passionately, I'm proven wrong. So I think that there's a difference between sort of saying that values are relative to cultures and the claim that just because somebody holds this view, therefore it's right. So I want to distinguish relativism from subjectivism. And does that make sense to you? Does that distinction?
Yeah, and I'm wondering if someone finds themselves in that position, then if somebody does not want to reach outside of their culture to some absolute value, some unchanging thing, something other than or beyond human to the ideal realm. If someone does not want to do that, where does that leave us in evaluating those two positions, or the example you brought up of the January storming of the Capitol?
Yeah. And so I also would just sort of stress, like, even if you do want to make that move to some sort of absolute or to some sort of trans-experiential supernatural being, the same problem presents itself, because what we find throughout human history is a lot of different such appeals, right? There's different religions. People disagree. It's one reason why there's religious wars. In fact, it's easier to go to war if you think that God is on your side, not the other guys. The sheer move to an absolute is going to find other people who are also absolutists. It's just they hold other absolutes. What I'm trying to suggest, or where I would take this conversation, is to say, I think that the opposite of absolutism in ethics, in moral issues, in political issues, is nihilism. It's not relativism. One view, absolutism, claims sort of like real values are absolute. They're not culturally relative and they exist. And the other one claims they are absolute, but they don't exist. And so I'm a nihilist. The relativist says that's not the nature of values at all. Values are relational terms. Nothing is good in itself. Good is a relation. To say that something is good is to state a triadic, a three-part relation. Something is good for some purpose for someone. When we are passing judgment on other cultures, we can do that in more or less informed ways. If there's something in your example of Seattle and contemporary Seattle and Africa, if there's something in another culture that seems on the face of it offensive and wrong, the question is, how does this look from the standpoint of that culture? How does ours look from them, from their standpoint? And is it possible, right? And that's really the heart of what philosophy is. It's why Socrates claims that the unexamined life is not worth living. When you make that judgment at the end of the day that this particular practice of this culture is wrong, you have to recognize that you're claiming that it's wrong in relation to some values that you hold. Is it possible for somebody then just to say, like, well, I don't hold those values? Of course it is. We've seen that throughout history. And I think that from a pragmatist standpoint, the issue then becomes less one of trying to beat somebody over the head with an argument, which I think doesn't work, and becomes more a question of what kinds of social conditions, what kinds of material conditions give rise to what kinds of views. It's hard to argue the racist or the sexist out of a racist or sexist view. Those views can be held in logically consistent ways. If you attack a premise that somebody holds onto, they tell you you're just doing it from the standpoint of some other premise. So the real question becomes for the pragmatist is what kinds of conditions give rise to sexism and racism, for example, in these examples, right? And how would I go about changing those? With adults, simply arguing with them, simply telling them that their views are wrong, rarely produces changes of action. It just rarely does. And the reason for that is clear because, again, in a non-technical sense, everybody is a kind of empiricist. Nobody walks around saying, like, I hold views precisely because my experience doesn't support them. No, people hold views because their lives confirm them. That confirmation is related to the culture that they're in and the customs they grew up with and the folks that they're around and the community that they're around. So I think that the idea of absolutism versus nihilism is not a problem to solve. It's a problem to dissolve. It starts out with a fundamental confusion about what the nature of values are. It starts out thinking that values are certain kinds of absolutes. One claims they exist, the other claims they don't. In fact, values are relations.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. There is some research that suggests that, echoing your point, that presenting an argument and going after different viewpoints from a very logical approach often isn't very effective. As you mentioned, people will find other ways to lean to a different premise. What do you find to be a typically effective way to persuade somebody else from their different vantage point, or to at least get them to open up to consider other vantage points?
There's a part of me that wants to say the answer to that question depends upon the context. I don't think that there's a universal key answer that just take two of these and call me in the morning and it works everywhere. But what I would say is that I think pragmatism is really helpful here in the sense that pragmatism understands a belief, what it means to have a belief. It understands belief as a habit of action. If somebody has a belief, it means that under certain conditions, they're prone to act in certain ways rather than others. The real important word there, I think, is the notion of habit, that this is the way in which they act. We only retain habits for the most part if we find them to be at least somewhat in some way successful. So we have to recognize that the belief that the other person holds that we think is wrong is for that person a habit which is being confirmed by experience, right? So I think the takeaway, which I think is one of the most important sort of pedagogical points in pragmatism, is if you want to change somebody's belief, the most effective way to do that is indirectly. It's not by arguing with them straight on. It's by changing the conditions that gave rise to that belief in the first place. So how do you do that? Sometimes that requires material change, right? In other words, sometimes what you have to say is, sorry, we know you're going to object to this, but we're going to desegregate the schools anyway. And this may not change your view, but we'll hope that it changes your grandchildren's view. Sometimes it's possible to say, hey, have you looked at it this way? Read this. Read this survivor's account. Read this victim's account. Will this begin to add to your experience? Will it increase your ability to see things in a different way? So I think that what you need to do, and I think that what effective teachers do, is not just sort of argue with you and tell you, you can't hold those views. Those are wrong. Those are silly. They give you resources to enlarge your experience, and then you find that your prior view is insufficient, right? That it doesn't, it's out of whack with your new experience. So I think that sometimes that comes through processes of education growing up, and sometimes that comes through social change that's more top down. Different examples, different ones would work. But I think that we've all had the example of being in discussions that turn into arguments with other people and walked away and thought, this generated a lot of heat and very little light. And there's a reason for that. There's something behind the beliefs that people have. And so I think that this kind of commitment to critically investigating your own assumptions is really crucial. And I think that it's, from a pragmatic standpoint, it lies at the heart of a democratic society. If you have a group of people who are unwilling to even examine the assumptions that they bring to their experience, that's a recipe for social division and conflict.
For me, this brings to mind the pragmatic nature of literature and art that can persuade us in very indirect ways. For me personally, I think of one of my personal favorite books, The Cider House Rules by John Irving, in which the novel is largely about a debate between two characters about abortion, but there's so much going on in the novel that for me, what pulled me in was everything else that's happening. And kind of through osmosis, a lot of these, the dialogue around abortion, I took that in indirectly, and it did change my views on a lot of things pertaining to those issues. And I think that is the power of literature, is being able to have people not feel like they're having to be attacked or forced to consider a different viewpoint because they're engaging with the content in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's a really good example. I know that book. I think that's a good example. I think that another aspect of that, right, another reason why literature and art are often effective at this in ways that philosophy is not, is that philosophers often write as though they're writing from a God's eye view, as if this is a universal truth. And so there's a kind of impersonal character to a lot of philosophy. It's about as personal as mathematics. And I think that what a lot of literature, certainly the book that you're talking about, does is it personalizes these issues. It shows us that this is, right, it could be the author's view, but it shows us that this is this character's view. And this other view is this character, and it makes it human as a result of that. And I think that a lot of academic, a lot of professional philosophy goes the other way at its own peril. And so I think that philosophers are often hesitant to say I, to make it clear that it's their view. I try to say I whenever I can, not because I'm the only I, but because I want to sort of make clear that I'm a living embodied person and I think this way and I'm speaking to other such people and tell me what you think. But I think that a lot of times what we see is kind of dry abstract arguments in philosophy that don't resonate. And then we see moving human drama in literature and art and we think, that's really effective. That's affective and therefore effective.
More recently, you've dug deeper into questions of human flourishing, living well, big topic. What are some of the approaches to those questions of what it means to live well that you find to be distracting or the wrong ways to approach those questions of how we ought to live well?
Well, I think that one way, which is, I'm not sure if it's a distraction, but I think in the end is ultimately not very successful, is the notion that these issues are merely or purely scientific or quantitative issues, that we can have a psychology of flourishing or a neurobiology of flourishing. Those fields give us extremely important data and information for thinking about flourishing. But the notion of flourishing itself is irreducibly a normative notion. It's a value notion. that's bound up, obviously, in the phrase, the good life. Good means that it's a value, right? Somebody is making a normative judgment. And so I think that the sort of approach to this that holds that somehow science will solve this issue rather than science will give us much needed information along the way towards solving this, I think is a real problem. So I appreciate very much the work that goes on in behavioral economics, in positive psychology, in neurobiology. Those fields by themselves will not generate an account of what the good life is. They will give us really crucial information in thinking about how to lead the good life, but by themselves, they're ineffective. Another view that I find to be completely unhelpful is, and to sort of pick up on something that we were saying earlier, is a kind of subjectivism, which simply holds that the way I'm living now is the best life or is the best life for me. And I don't need to be lectured at or talked to by somebody else who has some different idea of the sort of life that I should be leading. And so I think that there's a kind of real possibility there for fields like philosophy, for literature, for the arts, for humanities fields. I think the notion of the good life is a humanistic notion. And so philosophy, right? So professors lecture, right? Philosophy in Greek means love of wisdom. I think that's actually, I wish that my field was titled, instead of Philo love, Sophia wisdom, I wish it was Philo phronesis, of sort of practical wisdom. And I think that that's what philosophy has always been about. Philosophy has been Socrates stopping people on their way about their lives, interrupting them and asking them hard questions about what they're doing, with the goal of allowing them to lead more reflective, more meaningful, more intelligent lives. And so I really think that this kind of attention now to flourishing and well-being and thriving is really at the heart of the humanities and allows them to kind of reclaim central stage. One last thing that I would say, and you can feel free to interrupt me, is I think that it's also a real problem when one thinks of this as a self-help issue. When somebody thinks like, you're not thriving, you're not flourishing. Oh God, what's the matter with you? Just start flourishing. Do the things that you need to do. There is an element of self-help. We can all help ourselves in various ways, but flourishing depends upon social, ecological, cultural conditions as well. And no individual is necessarily positioned to be able to make those changes. You may find yourself in a desperately unfortunate situation, and for someone to sort of lecture you that you need to engage in more self-help is, I think, not only misguided, but ends up being really cruel. So I think that's a third way that things can go wrong. So when I see sort of attention to flourishing and thriving in self-help sections of bookstores, I sort of think that's really misleading, because the person who is working two jobs and still living below the poverty line and is told, just help yourself, that's very hollow. It's very nasty, I think. And it's not a question that we each of us depend only on ourselves. I'm all for a kind of self-reliance, but it's not the case that doing well, living well, is up only to us and to ourselves. It depends upon a community of people. It depends upon material conditions. It depends upon a lot that's outside of ourselves.
How might a pragmatist discern whether they are living the good life? If I'm looking at my life choices, decisions I've been making the past year, what I choose to eat, etc., how can I have some assurance as a pragmatist that I am living a good life?
I like the way that you put that, by saying some assurance, right? Because you're not going to ever have complete assurance. It won't be 100%. What I hear in that question is a central question in studies of flourishing, which is essentially, how do we measure flourishing? How do we know what counts as flourishing? I think the answer to that question is in multiple ways, right? Which I know is sort of infuriating and may seem like a dodge, but I don't think so. So one way, obviously, is through self-reporting. We could begin with you. And we could ask yourself, do you feel tired all the time? Are you living from sugar high and coffee high? Right. So how does it seem to you? How does your life seem to you? You might report, I'm not getting enough sleep. I'm not getting enough exercise. I'm having to work too many hours. I'm not seeing my friends enough. I don't have time for creative endeavors. Right. And I think that that's not decisive all by itself. I don't think any one factor is, but I think that self-assessments of how we're doing are necessary. I don't think they're sufficient, but they're necessary. It would be very strange for you to report, I feel miserable every day, and to have somebody tell you, but you're flourishing. right? It's sort of like, if it doesn't seem that way to you, then you're probably not flourishing. But so I think that starting with a kind of first person reporting is really crucial. I teach a course on this. And one of the things that I do is have students keep a journal tracking 11 or 12 variables. And it's very informative to them. It's like, you don't get graded on whether you had 7.5 or 8 hours of sleep, but it's very useful to them to see, how does this look to me? But a second thing is not a first person, but a third person account. How does this look to others? Right. So we all, unfortunately, probably have had experiences of a friend or an associate who thinks they're doing great, but we worry about them and we think, you're not well. And from some third person standpoint, it seems like there's a problem. And we can say, look, experience shows that people who do this kind of thing will have these sorts of problems, right? If you keep on this diet, you will have diabetes. If you keep spending money this way, you will be broke, right? So we don't have to use only our own experience. We're able to draw on the collective experiences of other people over a long period of time. Those things, again, are not decisive. It doesn't mean that we should just imitate what somebody else did, but they're useful. I think that's the old notion, actually, of Aristotle's idea of the golden mean, right? Which is, you can get close by seeing what works for other people, and then you have to fine tune it for yourself. And this, again, connects with our earlier discussion, because this is relative. And so what's right for someone else won't be exactly right for you. Aristotle's bright enough to recognize that an Olympic athlete shouldn't eat the same as a newborn baby. The proper diet is relative to the person. These questions, I think, can receive guidance from how other people have done it, from how other people have lived, what other people have found as results. But at the end of the day, there's also an irreducible element of how you report your own experience. So I think first person and third person reports together provide sort of the best insight that we can get.
What danger is there in this view of slipping into what is a common refrain of, you live your truth, or different strokes for different folks? How do we avoid the de-evolution into a reckless relativism?
Yeah, well, obviously, we're not doing a very good job of that now, right? So on many fronts. And so notions of alternative realities and alternative truths and so on. Again, that seems to me to be a kind of subjectivism. This is right because I think it's right for me. I think that's a real problem. I think that the country certainly sees that these days on political matters. There often seem to be people who claim, well, this is my truth. And I think the pragmatic response to that is, that remains to be seen. This is your view. Let's see if, after evidence is collected, that view stands up. Let's see if that view ends up being warranted. Or to go back to the beginning of your show, it may turn out that was something that you were wrong about. But I think that what you're pointing to is a combination of confirmation bias, which affects all of us, and the powers of social media and new forms of communication to put that confirmation bias on steroids by making sure that we hang out and are reinforced only by views that we already seek out, only by the news outlet that we listen to or watch, only by the friends that we have. And so at a time in which, in many ways, the world is more global, people have found little silos in which to exist. I think that's a huge threatening problem, not just personally, but for democratic social life. And so how do we do that? Because that's your question, right? How do we do that, right? And I think that there's sort of two answers to that. One is, in the face of some particular emergency, it's like, how do we respond to something that's happened? That's a kind of emergency response. And this, I can say more about that in a second. And the second is sort of a longer term, like, how do we prevent that from happening? How do we educate people to become folks who are part of what Karl Rove once called the fact-based community? And so there's a lot of people today in the United States who appear not to be members in the fact-based community. For anybody who's a pragmatist, who's committed to a kind of broadly empirical method in experimental thought, that's a significant problem. They've developed habits that put their trust, their epistemic trust, in other kinds of sources. That's a huge political problem. That's, in its broader sense, that's an educational problem. Emergency situations might require something else, right? In other words, there may need to be a commission that looks into something. There may need to be a fact finding sort of after the fact. But I think the long-term solution is, in the broadest sense, I don't mean schooling, but is educational. It has to do with the formation of the way in which people process information. We're all awash in data. We live in a society that's probably never had more data and information, and certainly the growth in wisdom has not matched the growth in data. And so I think that it's really, really important that people are given the skills to critically sort through competing claims. There's a whole bunch of voices in the online marketplace demanding attention and asking for people to follow them. How does one do that? How does one make that decision? That's a kind of critical thinking skill. We have obviously in significant ways failed to do that. And we have found that there are people who are really good at fanning those divisions as well.
You've mentioned there's a lot of cultural, social, and material conditions that enable us to live more flourishing lives. And you've alluded to a bunch of them, but I want to give you a chance here. What are some of the other conditions you think are necessary for us as human beings to live flourishing lives on a societal level?
Well, I think, sadly, we are a vulnerable and precarious lot. And so it's a fairly long list, right? But I think that health is a good place to start. If you live in a community with lead poisoned water, difficult to talk about that community as flourishing. If you are unable to either afford or obtain a kind of reasonable diet for yourself, such that you're badly nourished or unnourished, undernourished, that's a problem, right? So I would say health is one of those things. Bound up with health is a kind of stable, supportive, structural, sound environment. One of the dangers of climate change is the danger that it poses to people's ability to flourish in the future. So having clean water, not living in Seattle with 110 degree temperatures or forest fires at your doorstep every other week, those are important. So I think that health, environment, I think that sort of economic resources, it's not that everybody has to be Bill Gates, but there is a level of poverty below which it becomes difficult to say that somebody is flourishing. And so I think that having a certain kind of economic capacity to provide for the sorts of things that are needed, that's really crucial. I think that having a kind of secure environment, security is a great value for flourishing, that you have to be able to depend upon certain things. You need to know that you will not be stopped and thrown in jail over nothing. You need to know that there won't be people knocking on your door and taking you away. So there's a kind of security, a kind of social security that goes with this. I think there need to be outlets for creativity and inventiveness as well. There's lots of research that shows that that's tied to it, right? And so when the United Nations issues its World Happiness Report, right, which is a sort of funny sounding thing that the United Nations would, but it's an amazing document and it's very well done. There's a reason why year after year at the very top of its report are Scandinavian countries. Those are countries in which there is a smaller level of overall poverty and there's a higher level of security and a stronger social safety net. And these are conditions that are necessary for somebody's flourishing. And anybody who doesn't think so should simply try living without them because they're very important to our well-being. So I think that there are natural physiological preconditions and there are economic social preconditions. Last thing to say is having time that's not completely exhausted by work is crucial, right? And so there was a reason why labor unions and other workers' movements have tried to confine the workday from 12 hours to 10 hours to 8 hours, because there needs to be a time for relaxation and refreshment and inventiveness and creation. And those things are crucial to leading a flourishing life.
I want to end roughly where we started, John. What is perhaps the most, I know pragmatists don't like to hear the most,
no, that's okay,
but I'm going to drop it in there. But what is perhaps the most important thing pragmatism can offer us today? Are there any other particular problems you would like to apply pragmatism to as a means of unstiffening our thinking or helping us to progress and move forward?
Well, I think that we could answer that question by talking about specific issues, but let me answer in a more general way. And I think it is fine for pragmatists to talk about most. It's just the most is contextual. I think that what pragmatism offers us today that from my standpoint is most important is an alternative to being optimists or pessimists, right? So I think an optimist is somebody who thinks things are going to be good in the future. maybe great, but at least good. And a pessimist is somebody who thinks things will be bad. And both of those have a kind of crystal ball, I'm telling you what the future is going to be like, view to them. They're predictive. I don't think of pragmatism as either pessimistic or optimistic. I think of it, in William James's word, as melioristic. It says, I don't know exactly what's going to happen in the future. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you how things are going to be. But what I can do is to tell you that it is more likely that you will achieve your goals if you roll up your sleeves and work toward them. You may work toward them and still not get there, but you're really unlikely to get there if you don't do that work. So I think that we have in our society and in the world today, some folks who are paralyzed by a kind of useless optimism where they just sort of assume everything is going to be fine. Progress is inevitable. Things work out. And there's other people who I think are paralyzed by a kind of pessimism and who think, why bother? It's hopeless. It's not going to work. And I think that what pragmatism says is nobody knows the future that well to be in that kind of metaphysical speculation basis, but business. What we need to do is to say these things are real, genuine possibilities. We need to roll up our sleeves and work at them. And then we'll see. I think that attitude is the most important aspect of pragmatism. The notion that there are real possibilities, they're not automatic, we can work for them, we can strive for them, and that striving will produce results. Not every time, not completely, but more than if we hadn't.
John, thank you so much for coming on the show, offering us some new hits to pragmatism, and wish you all the best in your future endeavors.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's wonderful to talk with you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.